This podcast is rated S for science and also for spoilers and swearing. There's going to be swearing.
Something is killing these people and sucking them dry.
Run! It's a stampede!
The Callisto effect.
What's that?
It's a commonly held belief that life evolved gradually by natural selection. Dr. Frock argues that sometimes there are sudden evolutionary changes that create a grotesque and short-lived aberrant species.
Welcome, everybody, to Cinematic Animalia, your weekly foray into the biology of movie monsters. Today, we are looking at the 1997 museum monster movie, Relic. I will go over some news first, tell you a bit about this movie, our thoughts, and then get stuck into the science that the movie brings up, including rapid mutation in species, species somehow going undetected until the present day, and then Libby will talk about some cryptid species from South America, cryptid species being the likes of Bigfoot, Chupacabra, and what was that thing, Adam, that we found a lot of in Tennessee? Jackalopes?
The jackalope.
As always, the show will be broken up into a few different segments. We'll have time codes below, so by all means, skip ahead to whatever tickles your fancy today. But before we get stuck in, my name's Sam Perrin. I'm an invasive ecologist and climate data analyst based in Trondheim, Norway. I also run the website Ecology for the Masses alongside Adam Harsik, a diseased ecologist at the Ben University Negev of the Gurion. Alongside Adam is the Baroness, Her Ladyship Libby Young. I'm not doing an accent today because the only notable accent was a New York accent. Whenever I try to do a New York accent, I sound Rastafarian, which is quite offensive.
You should try to do a Chicago accent for today's episode.
What's Janice from Friends? Is she New York as well?
Janice? Like Fran Drescher?
Oh my God. And last but not least, we are joined by Dave, a vet and our movie physiologist. And also, I didn't get there in the end because I went off the rails, but Libby is our story specialist and a writer at Short Story Soup. For those who can't see, Adam is rocking the most old man dressing gown I've ever seen. I'm expecting him to just pick up a newspaper and chase some kids off his lawn any second. And when I say kids, I do mean Ibex.
My pipe is in the other room, but we need to get some more tobacco for it.
I was going to say, I really appreciate all those derogatory remarks, considering that's my fucking robe.
Well, I'm sure you look like less of an old man when you wear it.
More of like one.
But would an old man have this mullet?
I don't know, if he hadn't been to the hairdressers for a while.
What if he went on Thursday?
Nice. Who's got some news?
I have a little bit of news. So we've talked a little bit before about how the world government should be a lot more concerned about climate change, and people talk about this more after Don't Look Up, and of course it takes a fucking movie for people to care about anything. But this last year, 2021, aka 2020 Part 3, well that's this year, sorry, 2020 Part 2, yeah. 2021 was the third costliest year on record for weather disasters. $343 billion US dollars in damages from the extreme climate change-driven weather events. Things like the floods in Germany, the crazy storms that hit the US, and the fires in Australia.
Probably unrelated.
We should point out that it's not just climate scientists who are saying this. The World Economic Forum released a report 2 weeks ago. Every year they bring out a report with the biggest economic risks in the short term, so in the next 2 years, midterm next 5 to 10 years, and the long term. And this year, short-term risks like extreme weather events were higher on the list than COVID-related events. So, for the last 3 years, climate change, extreme weather, and biodiversity loss have consistently been in the top three for the mid to long-term threats. So, this is a massive threat to our economy. They think it's going to shave about 18% off of the world's GDP by the end of the decade. Like, there was a statement by a British politician recently who said every £1 that we spend on climate mitigation is going to save us £9 of repair costs in the future.
There's a huge, huge thing. 8% might not sound like a lot to you, but usually these GDP changes
18.
Are 18, sorry. 18,
yep.
Still, that's even worse than I thought. One-fifth may not seem like a lot, but these changes are usually talked about in the single digits, if not the fraction of a percentage, not 18 whole percent.
It just confirms what climate scientists have been saying all along. You think COVID's bad, nothing compared to what the climate crisis is going to do to us.
Yep. So that's fun. Hot and hot and so
hot and hurt. This week, a remote South American indigenous group have either a strange grudge against the city of Chicago or an incredibly dark sense of humor as they infect an American anthropologist who is just looking to eat a little soup with a virus that transforms him into a murderous lizard man chimera with a taste for a special kind of salad and human brains. Craving the devil's lettuce, he hops aboard a freighter headed home, transforms, has a below-deck bilge buffet on the crew, and then continues his monstrous murderous search for his wacky tobacco leaf in his office of the Field Museum of Natural History in Chicago. A superstitious cop teams up with an absolute cunt, who is an evolutionary biologist, to analyze the creature whilst it is simultaneously running amok in the museum they are all trapped in after the world's worst or possibly greatest security system is tripped. Rich bitches and snobby knobs get their comeuppance, as well as the endearing buddy cop duo, which, to be honest, should have been the main characters of the movie, but I go on. But the doc manages to channel her inner chemist and destroys the man-turned-monster with a good old-fashioned chemical fire.
Wow, that was great. That was one of my favorite.
Yeah. What do we like about this? I'm very interested to hear people's opinions on this, because this was an interesting movie.
As it's kind of touted to be, sort of like Alien meets Jurassic World, the concept in the movie was tried and true 90s formulaic, but fun. The monster was cool, the practical effects were great, and the characters were tenable to terrific. So it kind of felt like solid throughout, nothing like, oh wow, this is my favorite movie ever, but it was definitely like an enjoyable ride. And then my second favorite thing, I have to say, was the panic scene of people fleeing the museum. It was so awesome. The woman who gets crushed in the revolving door was like a "oh" moment, which was great. I feel like these extras were extra in like the best possible way. I don't know if the director gave them like the best pep talk of their life before the scene, or fed them a bunch of shrooms and did not tell them about the monster and just like let it loose, but they like stole the show. Like the panic was completely palpable. It was great.
Palpable panic. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I will agree with all that. And I think for me, it's just a really fun monster flick that I was 100% along for especially the very beginning of the movie. Like it just gets right into it. There's shit going down, you got stakes, you're stuck in this museum with these very unfortunate characters, but you have the best buddy cop duo, as Libby mentioned in the beginning, who are the favorite.
I thought the monster looked really, really cool. I was a little disappointed we didn't get a better look at it at any point. Like, there was no one, there were a couple of decent shots, but I was kind of hoping for a bit more. There was some really realistic views of academia in this too. Which we can talk a little bit about later. And so I read the book beforehand. The book, I mean, you know, it's 480 pages, so it fleshes a lot more stuff out. It's better. But this is a really good translation of a book to a movie.
Cool.
Everything that they cut out or changed, I was like, yeah, I can totally see why you get rid of that. You have to condense two or three characters into one. And I mean, there were some reverse characterizations, but I thought it all worked. I thought it was a pretty good translation. I mean, it's not all positives there, which we'll get into soon, but yeah, I enjoyed that.
I agree with everything you guys said. Plus, I really enjoyed some of the throwaway characters in this. The pathologist is fantastic. The one who's just like cracking jokes the entire time she's doing the autopsy.
Oh my God, I forgot about her.
Right.
She's amazing.
Don't you hate it when you or someone gives head without taking it? And like,
don't you agree? Yes.
He never shuts up. Yeah. I also, similar to Libby, loved the buddy cop dynamic when the two of them are like split up and you can hear playing in the background the like, in your own head, the Sarah McLachlan, like, I will remember you, as the two of them get, like, moved apart, and then both of them get killed, and I just kept thinking, like, good. I don't want one of them to live without the other.
What did we detest about this? For instance, did we think there were any cunts in this film?
Just one giant one. Aside from her, which, I mean, she's just objectively a horrible person. I thought it was a bit too long. I felt like there was some stuff they could have left on the cutting room floor, like, i.e. the whole two kids in the beginning. Like, it was, like, the most pointless lead up to, like, absolutely nowhere.
They get brutally murdered in the book. Yeah, they get fucking ripped apart. Yeah.
Yeah, I figured, but it was just, like, because they didn't show it, which I don't, I'm not arguing that they should have, it just was, like, the fuck was that?
Yeah.
You
already had another guy get killed in, like, the same
scene. Yeah, exactly. And then I'll say for a dark lit creature feature, I think it got a little too dark, like, visually. Very reminiscent of the infamous Game of Thrones episode. The quickest way, in my opinion, to lose an audience is to take them out of the fantasy, is to visually impair them to a point where they can't see what the fuck is going on. So I feel like there was definitely a couple scenes where I was, like, having trouble just distinguishing, like, what I was looking at. Like, is it a wall? Is it the Cthulhu? Is it the horrible human being that's our female lead?
Yeah, I think I would agree with all the points that you raised. There are movies that use natural light to great effect, as opposed to having, like, a lot of, you know, backlit sets. There's a really good movie called It Comes at Night, or They Come at Night. I think it's It Comes at Night, and they use only natural light. It Comes at Night. And it makes for a really tense movie. Like, it's dark, you can only see what the characters can see. But in this one, you have late 90s shitty mag lights, which are the size of your arm, but are weaker than your fucking phone screen, much less your phone's flashlights. And so that's useless. And much like their visual cues they took from The Long Night of Game of Thrones, I felt they took their audio from Tenet or Tenet, and you can't hear a goddamn thing. There's just crashing, insane music going over the top of people trying to have a conversation, or yelling at each other, or hero cop in the sewer who's just screaming at everybody who are standing 1 meter or 3 feet away from him when they're supposed to be quiet. Like, what the fuck is happening with this? And after the probably about halfway point, the movie just kind of fell apart for me as a cohesive unit. I was really enjoying it to that point, and then it was just kind of like, oh, yeah, this is still going on, I guess. Okay.
A lot of what I don't like about this is addendums to what I said before. So I thought it was a really good translation of the book, but the book's kind of, I mean, it's fun, but it's a bit meh. So if you get a good translation of a meh book, you get a meh movie.
Polishing a turd.
I mentioned before that lots of the reverses of the characterizations were fine, and I completely understood them, apart from Margot Green, who I feel is quite likable in the book, and is just the worst here. Like, she is just constantly making fun of, like, anthropology, superstition, all this sort of stuff. She reminds me of, like, I don't know, how me and Adam were when we were master's students. We were just like, fucking social science. Get the fuck out of here with that soft shit. She's the worst, basically. We'll get into some of the academic stuff later on.
Yeah, even just the way she treats the detective. Like, he's just, like, asking her normal questions, and she's like, fuck you.
Yeah. Like, she's like, nowhere. I saw that man every day for the, you know, last year. I cared about him. And then he's like, okay, well, can you help us, like, figure out what happened to him? No, go to fucking hell.
He's like, just trying to ask her a question. She's just walking away from him. He's like, hey, excuse me. And she just keeps walking, like, fuck.
She also gets mad at him for seeing the dead body. And she's like, oh, well, you should have done a better job of shutting the door behind you. Like, you burst into the room after him in an area with police set at the door.
Not just the room, an obvious crime scene.
Yeah. And, like, making, you know, like, for instance, Linda Hunt's character was a complete asshole in the book. Quite likable in the film.
Yeah. That's Linda Hunt.
The curator?
Yeah. Edna Mode herself. But who else? The mayor in the book. Quite a nice guy. Bit of a piece of shit in this one.
Insane behavior.
But that's fine. Like, they're not main characters. But when you have the protagonist and you take them and make them so unlikable when that's not what the source material gives you, it's a very strange choice. And also, another thing we'll get into later, the science in this movie goes off the fucking deep end really quick. And it does in a lot of other movies. I'll explain why I feel that's a crime in this movie, particularly later on.
My frustrations with this film are the same as you guys, plus a couple that are far more personal. My two cats are named Castor and Pollux, and having the dogs named that,
I thought of you.
Yeah, it caused me to turn around and find my partner holding both of the cats and explaining to them that she wouldn't let a monster eat them in real life. I don't think that she's fully recovered. My
especially Castor.
Yeah, right. My second struggle that I had with this movie is everybody's use of doors when it comes to the monster. So Tom Sizemore has that great scene where the monster is like running down the hallway towards the metal door, and he slams the door in the monster's face and nothing happens. And he has enough time to like put the lock in before the monster starts hitting on the door and bending the entire thing over. And I'm like, you thought you were just going to close the door in the monster's face right before it hits. And then you have time to like,
this rhino sized right. monster charging down a corridor. Right.
And then
it waited. It was polite.
There's two more stupid door scenes of one, the weird scene where Tom Sizemore forces her into the lab and he's like, lock the door behind you. You'll be safe in there. I'm going to like fight the monster, just for her to lock the door, which he's already established he thinks will keep the monster out. And then he's on the other side of the door, banging on the door and shooting at it and trying to open it. And like, your understanding of doors here is very questionable. And then I absolutely loved the scene of her running down the wooden doors with the glass windows and she's shutting all of them behind her. And then the big monster just runs through all of them like it's paper for a solid like 3 seconds.
Open the door or I'm going to throw rocks through your windows, you dumb whore.
Trivia. Libby, do you want to go first with yours?
Yeah. So I have some trivia based this week on my actual own internet sleuthing abilities, which are meager at best. So of all the websites that I visited talking about the relic, except the most important one, Stan Winston is credited with the creation of the Cathoga. However, from the website of the Stan Winston School of Character Arts itself, it says this, and I'm going to read it directly from it. Based on the sketchy description in the original novel by Douglas Preston and Lincoln Child, lead concept artist Mark Crash McNeary made a number of Cathoga designs, and director Peter Hyams, I think that's how you say his name, Peter Hyams, chose his favorite one, and it continually credits McNeary as the creature's designer. I think that people saw Stan Winston School of Arts and they're just like cut off the school and said it was Stan Winston that designed it. But nowhere on his actual website, it does not credit Stan Winston for the Cathoga. It credits Mark Crash McNeary.
Hmm.
Sort of continuing on with that bit of trivia. So like reading from the website, basically, the supervisor, Christopher Swift, ran the Relic project on set, and they had a ton of challenges due to the non-anthropomorphic Cathoga designs. It was really difficult to configure a human being into the suit itself. Basically, the actors, so there is an actor inside of Cathoga. And they were in a horrible position putting like all their weight on arm extensions, back leg extensions. It was like super uncomfortable to deal with. But the funny part is, Vincent Hammond, who is one of the two character actors who actually get into the Cathoga suit, because he was like so uncomfortable, as a way to like mentally deal with being in there, he would recite from the book, The Prophet. So it was just having this full Cathoga costume on and hearing it speak The Prophet pages.
The poetry collection?
Yeah.
By Khalil Gibran? Mm-hmm. So it's just like a monster reciting poetry to you.
A-Sapien.
Nice.
Yeah, so like I said, it was a really, really uncomfortable design. And Mark Crash McNeary said he felt the weight of responsibility from that decision. He said that the production team and puppeteering crews and obviously the characters, actors themselves, like every day from their shoot, they would just come in exhausted from all these Herculean efforts that required, you know, to get the performance out of the Cathoga. So he said, and I'm quoting him here, "I felt bad when the guys came back from the set talking about how miserable it was to work with this character. I had tried to give the director something very different, but ultimately I designed something without considering the actor inside it. It was a real lesson in how careful I had to be when I was executing a design. I learned a lot on the Relic. I just wish I'd learned it without people suffering."
It's a really good quote.
Did he take that knowledge into like other character designs? Like,
yeah, I think that's what he was saying. I further in the interview was basically saying like this was his first one where he had to design a creature for a character actor inside the suit, and he just like did not take that into consideration. And so anthropomorphically, it was really, really hard on the character actors. And so going forward, he like used that knowledge to then make it more comfortable. And, you know, so you can get a better performance out of it, right? Because if it's hard to move, then your creature's going to look dumb as hell.
I will say, though, I want to thank him for making this impossible creature, because we don't have to justify this coming from a hominid ancestor because it has a shoulder.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what I thought was really interesting was the fact that the book that this is based on is called the Prendergast series, after one of the main characters, who they get rid of completely. The character that this entire series is based around mm-hmm. is not in this film at all, which I'm not complaining about, because I think he's a pretentious asshole. So I'm quite glad they got rid of him.
He's an FBI agent, right?
Yeah, he's an FBI agent who's right. just... You know that 90s, kind of early 2000s character who, oh, you just think is some grunt, but he's actually, like, really refined and cultured, and he just recites poetry.
recites the prophet.
Yep.
He recites the prophet. Yeah, he's just, in the books, he's just constantly quoting poetry, and I'm like, shut up, dude. Alfred Molina was lying in Spider-Man 2, okay? That's not going to get you any women. And Douglas Preston, the guy who was one of the people who wrote this book, was formerly a public relations director at the New York Museum for Natural History. And the New York Museum for Natural History, amazing naturalist museum, by the way, knocked them back because they thought this movie would be bad for business. The Chicago Field Museum, on the other hand, loved the idea. And they were like, yeah, sure, you can film that here. But then they didn't call it the Chicago Field Museum in the movie.
They did not.
No, they call it the Chicago Museum of Natural History, which is, it implies a more natural history bent than the Field Museum actually has. The Chicago Field Museum, by the way, one of the best museums I've ever been to in my life.
Fantastic museum.
It's incredible, yeah. And they have massive sections dedicated to archaeology and anthropology as well, which is why I think it's really interesting that in this movie, some of the scientists there are portrayed as saying, anthropology, bloody useless relics, superstitions, dumb, all that sort of shit.
That belongs in a museum! So do you!
So, before we start looking at the science, if you've got any thoughts or questions, you can find Adam and I on Twitter. I am at Big Dr. Fishboy. Adam is at Harsic Adam. If you want to get in touch with the podcast, you can visit our website, cinematicaanimalia.com, or email us at cinematica.animalia@gmail.com. If you want to read more of Libby's work, you can visit shortstorysoup.substack.com and read a veritable smorgasbord of short stories. And if you want to hear about some of the less movie-related ecology that Adam, myself, and a massive team of international writers churn out on a weekly basis, you can check out ecologyforthemasses.com. And as always, if you're listening right now, we'd love it if you could give us an in-app rating. It really helps. And if you've got any suggestions for monsters going forward, we'd love to hear them. We are always looking for suggestions from the listeners.
Obviously, our focus today is going to be on the monster, which, Sam, do we have a... We're just going to call it the Kothoga, because its name...
That's what they call it in the movie.
A lot of the anatomy of the Kothoga, we've talked about in other creatures before. It's got thick, bulletproof skin. There's nothing that's bulletproof, but it could have thick, keratinized skin, like a rhinoceros or a hippo. It does...
It might allow the bullet to maybe glance off it if it's, you know, a side shot, or just get stuck in the muscle wall.
A long prehensile tail. It's got big claws, we've talked about. There's no way a creature of this size could climb up the building the way it does, although that is objectively a cool scene when it's chasing the FBI agents.
Oh, it's doing it so slowly as well. It's not fussed at all. It knows it's going to get that guy.
Taking
just
his
pacing itself.
And the tusk mechanism... I don't have a great explanation of it. The one that it uses to like cut the heads off,
which is fantastic.
It's great. It's so cool.
Maybe sexual selection, like some sort of fighting with other males.
There's some weird mix of mandibles in terms of it can actually open and collapse them to cut with. The closest I could find to a reptile that had tusk was the boar croc. Which grew extended teeth kind of off the side of its face. There's no true reptile that has tusks.
Okay. I think this is a mammal, though. I don't think this is a reptile.
The two bigger areas that I wanted to talk about today in relation, because I thought they were the coolest for this creature, are one, its consumption of the hypothalamus and addiction of the plant, as well as the mutagenic and hormonal properties of the plant, or in the movie's case, fungus that it looks to consume. Now, the hypothalamus is an organ that's found in mammals. It's located, I mean, if you want to think about it, it's kind of behind your eyes in terms of its space on your brain. And its biggest role is it has a whole series of different hormones that it releases into the blood to cause a bunch of different features to take part. There is a posterior and anterior component of your pituitary gland. The posterior is boring. It releases hormones that help with childbirth and help you to retain water so that you don't pee so much. Vasopressin or antidiuretic hormone is the hormone you mess with when you drink.
You heard it here. Dave thinks childbirth is boring.
I was about to say that super boring process of childbirth.
And apparently Dave doesn't care that much for not peeing himself either.
Yeah, I'm water retention, actually. You want to try to keep that water in. But okay, the interior...
He's got those incontinence diapers. He doesn't need anything else.
The interior part of the hypothalamus, in terms of the interior pituitary, releases much more, in my opinion, cool hormones that do a whole bunch of things ranging from controlling outputs during stress situations to allowing for coordinations of your circadian rhythm. Now, the creature in this film is repeatedly seen to be consuming the hypothalamus. And it's hinted at that it needs to consume a lot of this because the amount of the hormones, compounds, substances that it's lacking that it gets from the plant are far greater. I think he makes a comment at one point that it would take 1 milligram of hypothalamus, or sorry, it would take 1 milligram of the plant to equal 1,000 milligrams of hypothalamus. So, I mean, this creature is voraciously hungry if that's the case. One of the conditions that can develop in the absence of hypothalamic compounds is Addison's disease or hypoadrenocorticism. And I don't know if you guys know what this is.
Nope.
Never heard of it.
So this is something we commonly run into in veterinary medicine. And basically, it's an underproduction of stress hormones. Animals or humans that are afflicted with this experience abdominal pain, dehydration, depression, diarrhea, muscle weakness, nausea. They get a whole collection of symptoms. It's actually often referred to as the great pretender because it can be a whole bunch of other different things or look like a bunch of different things. But the short answer is just the stress hormones that you allow you to sort of regulate yourself are absent or not occurring in large enough quantities. Now, a much more dangerous reaction takes place called an Addisonian crisis. If an animal that is Addisonian finds themselves in a situation where they get sick or they get really stressed and their body goes looking for stress hormones it doesn't have, they can develop into a state where they experience extreme weakness, high fever, paleness, vomiting, diarrhea, and they can die really quickly. So if our creature is potentially running low on hypothalamic compounds, I'm going to suggest that this is potentially one of the mechanisms that's taking place. It's basically not getting the hormones that it needs to mount effective responses. I could agree with feeling absolute shitty if you're feeling depressed and lethargic and out of it, and you know that you just have to consume human brain to try and get that energy level back up. It's feeling crappy. It's a big driver for why it might want to look to eat some of these substances.
But would there be any kind of drive for that? Because I think this is something that I might have learned about previously in my education at some point, but I think Libby really brought this point to me when we first started dating about how when you're hungry for a certain thing, like wanting a big juicy red steak, it's because you're low on a specific substance in your body. So your body knows to look for that, to eat it.
The brain associations with what you receive that nutrient from the most.
Yeah.
So normally no, but I'm going to sort of get around this a little bit through two different mechanisms. So the first of which, terrible as it is going to be heroin addiction. So heroin, basically, if you take it in from an IV situation, it passes into the blood. The way that it works is once it's gone into the brain and once it's undergone a process called deacetylation, and then basically becomes two different compounds, one of which is morphine, they bind to opioid receptors in the brain. They give you a euphoric, analgesic, or pain relief, anti-anxiety, and kind of generalized high that you experience. Now, that's the short-term effect. Heroin addicts, one of the most dangerous things that takes place is the body is really good at not producing something if it doesn't have to. And in situations where we have people that are taking heroin for a long period of time, their body stops producing natural painkillers. And one of the hardest things that we see with heroin addicts that basically are coming down and they have to go cold turkey or stop taking heroin, since their body is no longer producing natural painkilling mechanisms, they feel everything. And I've been told that people undergoing heroin withdrawal claim that they can feel their fingernails growing, or they can feel like the lightest breeze or the hair on their arms. There's just hypersensitivity throughout the roof.
Yeah,
that makes a lot of sense.
I've heard someone talking about, like, when someone was talking next to them, they could feel like the breath from someone talking, like, on their skin.
Right. So if this creature has basically been given large dosages of this plant for a long extended period of time, it would have to be way longer than what we've seen in the movie, its brain is eventually going to say, hey, I'm getting all of these hormones exogenously or from an outside source. I'm going to stop producing my own. And then in the absence of this, the creature is going to find itself in a situation where it's not going to be getting these. And I think it is going to start experiencing an Addisonian event. Now, why would it be consuming human brains? What is the drive? This kind of leads into the book that I feel wasn't touched on as much in the movie. But in the book, they talk about the fact that the creature is really smart. And if it has been getting exposure for a long period of time, if it does have Dr. Whitley or Witty or whatever the name of the scientist, if it's still got some of his intelligence and this creature has been conditioned to basically say, hey, here is an area, if you eat these humans and bite into this source that you can get it, you could create an unnatural drive or an unnatural hunger. It would have to be trained. We treat Addison's really, well, I don't want to say easy, but we can give supplemental stress hormones in humans and animals that have this condition to help basically regulate them on a regular basis. Sadly enough, if this creature is experiencing what I think it is, it could have probably just stopped into a pharmacy, got a decent prescription, and been started on a fairly low-cost medication for the rest of its life.
He's not that smart, then.
Yeah, you big dumb lizard. Go to the pharmacy.
What do you mean you don't have your ID with you?
Well, I was about to say, it's America, so he probably doesn't have enough money to afford whatever fucking prescription drug.
Just one of those ideas where if this movie was in Canada, it would have been over much quickly, because it just gets itself some nice prescription medicine.
Now, the idea that this creature is forming an Addisonian event, and that's kind of its driver of it feels sick, it feels awful, and it goes out to consume, this fits. But there were three more theories I wanted to pass through you guys that I think you'd get quite a laugh out of. So the hypothalamus also plays large roles in erectile activity. So I also want to argue that another theory could have been that without consumption of the hypothalamus, our poor guy just couldn't get it up. And that was his driver of basically his human Viagra. Two, without oxytocin, right, the hormone that's associated with feelings of love and deep connections, as well as a key hormone in childbirth, I'm worried that our creature just wouldn't experience feelings of deep connection with other creatures, and maybe it's consuming the hypothalamus because it just wants to love and feel loved. And then the last possibility is exactly as Sam pointed out. In the absence of vasopressin or antidiuretic hormone, he's just going to be peeing constantly. So maybe his driver for why he needs to consume the hypothalamus is because he's just getting up in the night like 6-7 times a night to piss. And finally, he just sort of hits his bit and he's like, you know what? I'm just going to start consuming people because I just can't continue living like this.
I would rather eat people than wear adult nappies. It's just, you know, adult diapers. That's embarrassing. Killing a person and eating their brains.
Yeah.
Much preferable. I like that last one the best, if you hadn't picked up on that already.
See, I was going to make a joke about eating heads to get head for the first one.
I like that.
A census taker once tried to test me. I ate his liver with some fava beans and a nice Chianti.
The other subject that I wanted to talk about here is the plant and the idea of rapid mutations taking place.
The plant or the fungus? Right. Because the fungus is on the plant and that's what has the viral changing.
So in the book, it's the plant. In the movie, it's the fungus that's occupying these that creates the mutagenic properties it contains a whole variety of different DNA that seems to combine into our organism, as well as hormones from a number of different species that allow for rapid growth and rapid change.
It's odd though, because I'm not saying it's stupid or anything. I want to know the rationale behind somebody saying, no, the consumption of a plant is too far-fetched for this thing to turn into a reptile, but a fungus.
On the plant.
People will buy that.
I think they might have...
Well, the issue there is I think a lot of people don't know that a fungus and a plant are not the same thing.
That is true, yeah. Mushrooms are much more closely related to animals, so us, than plants are, actually. They're three of the main kingdoms, which is like the highest level of phylogeny. So, Animalia, Plantae, and Fungi.
I think they had a scientific advisor on here for the movie who actually told them that it makes more sense to have fungi than plants. A mutagen is a chemical or physical phenomenon that promotes errors in DNA replication. So, in terms of plants or fungus, naturally occurring mutagens, they're usually discovered in situations of outbreak, primarily in agriculture. But the ones that are sort of good examples are a range of mycotoxins produced by various fungi. And really, the only ones they found in plants are actually two unidentified agents in bracken. So fungus naturally do produce these really cool mutagenic compounds. And there's some great papers that have come out in the last decade looking at the fact that the fungus actually have to produce their own protective mechanisms to make up for the fact that a lot of these mutagenic compounds they produce are secondary metabolites. They don't mean to be growing these, or at least we think they don't mean to be growing these. Maybe they have some sort of bactericidal or, you know, properties that help to protect them. But as far as we can tell, they make these unwanted mutagenic compounds and then they're like, fuck off. And they have to produce their own compounds to protect themselves from the byproducts they make, which is fun.
I think it's also worth reinforcing here that mutagens matter in this case because errors in DNA replication is how we get different species. It's how everything is different from everything else on this planet. You have some error that happens and adenine ends up being a guanine, or, you know, a C becomes a G, cytosine becomes a guanine. And for most of these errors, absolutely nothing happens. Your body has a lot of, for your cells at least, for all this DNA replication, they have a lot of checking mechanisms in place that if an error happens, it can fix it. There's redundancies in place, everything is usually fine. If there is an effect, it's usually bad, and it can either lead to a reduced quality of life or just straight up kill the organism that is experiencing this kind of mutation. In very, very, very small cases, you have these mutations lead to a positive effect, which may produce some kind of advantage for the organism. It is selected on, and it is more successful, and you get a different species eventually.
So that's solution for half of our problem, which is they say that this fungus has mutagenic properties. It's allowing for mutations that would take place that would lead for some of the physical deformities we see. It would not lead for a crossing of genetic material where this thing starts to become reptilian or insectoid or undergoes whatever processes that start to change it, but it could lead to some fucked up mutations. They almost always would be bad. Now, the other point that they...
If they had an effect.
The other point that they repeatedly make comments about are that these fungus are producing a large amount of hormones, growth hormones and hormones that allow for alteration and change and regulation of size. I couldn't find any examples in the literature of fungus that produce animal hormones. They apparently can potentially be modified so that you can get them to grow them with genetic engineering. But generally speaking, fungus have actually their own set of hormones, which I got into a real rabbit hole last night of reading about, that are important for sexual reproduction because they inhibit asexual growth. So they actually can kick into place to say, all right, stop fucking yourself and go out and have sex with other people, which just feels like kicking a teenager out of the attic. Exactly. I have cut off the internet. Your porn is down. Please go on a date with Sarah. She seems like a lovely girl.
Jokes on you, Mom. I found Dad's Playboys. Sorry, too personal?
Now, on the other hand, we have lots of records of plants that can naturally produce mammalian hormone analogs. So they can produce progesterone, testosterone, estradiol, compounds that could potentially mimic a lot of the substances that our creatures undergoing. So I would like to posit that this plant is twofold, which is why it was important to send back the leaves. I think the leaves are probably producing natural hormone analogs that this thing is taking in, and the fungus are producing some form of mutagen. And it's the combination of the two which is important, which is why he sends back both. He doesn't just scrape off the fungus and leave it in like a couple of jars for himself. He sends back the plants and the fungus.
It could also be that the fungi depend on the plant for life, or they both depend on each other. It could be that they're a symbiosis or a parasitic relationship.
Feeding from the anger that I would have loved to see where he breaks into his office and finds out that all of the leaves have been burned. I can't imagine a louder fuck outside of the first season of The Witcher, but just a nice long, like, him sitting in the office, staring down the hallway at the burner as he watches the leaves go, and just the creature like, fuck.
That's my entire supply.
Gone.
I also love the biologists who look at this box full of biological specimens and think, the idiot didn't send us anything. There's just plants in here.
Burn it!
Fucking
immediately.
Morons.
Oh, this fungus is what's changing him. Let me touch it with my bare hands.
And then throw it into the sewer, which is probably full of who knows how many other animals and bacteria.
In the water supply, yeah.
One of my friends and former colleagues at the Museum of Natural History was a genetic botanist. Would have had a fucking fit watching this shit. There's no, like, presses either. Like, it's just like a bunch of plants sent in a crate. There's been no like categorization of it or anything like that.
No preservation.
What do you mean by presses?
You know how you do a plant press?
Oh, okay.
Label it and between two sheets and that sort of thing. Yeah. What you learn in like high school when you do that in a botany class is very close to what they actually do. I asked Vanessa if she could, you know, get us some like special paper so Eric could do some plant presses and have a bit of a collection. She was just like, it's no special paper. Like, you can just use A4 shit you find at home. And I was like, are you telling me that what I did in high school is pretty much the same as what you guys do? She's like, yeah, more or less.
Fun.
Cool.
Well, wouldn't they send the plants back in the crate? And not do the presses because the plants need as much room as possible.
Nice. I felt the greatest area of support for this poor deformed creature walking around was that asthmatic noise that I don't know who decided to add in, but it's great. Every time that thing is near you and all you hear is the like, as it's breathing its way, this giant creature moving around. And I was like, oh, you are not having a good time.
In the book, every time the creature's in the presence of humans, they always describe this horrifying smell that comes along. But you can't really do that in a movie. So I feel like they tried to replace it with an equally threatening noise that you could, you know, that translates to this sort of media a little better.
I think that's unfortunate because it's a similar thing they did in the Jurassic Park books, or at least Jurassic Park, the first one, talking about just that charnel house smell that you get from a predator that eats a bunch of raw meat and just has a bunch of nasty shit caught in its teeth, and it just smells awful. And he would smell this thing coming from a long way away.
Yeah, it would definitely smell more like fetid.
Fetid is actually the word that they use constantly in the book. Fetid and goatish.
Goatish.
Okay, so the main premise of the movie is that this is a creature who was human that has mutated into this sort of species, which is frankly bonkers. And we'll get into why I hate it so much later on. But the most plausible explanation for this would just be that you have a creature that has survived in the depths of the Amazon for, you know, millennia by itself. In the 90s and 80s, you know, when this thing sort of would have popped up, deforestation in the Amazon was much, much lower than it is now. We'll get into why this still can't kind of work later on, but I want to take the optimist route for now. Could this have survived since the extinction of the dinosaurs? No.
No,
definitely not. Yeah. They make mention of how it's a little more saurian. Adam and I pointed out that it is kind of similar to, again, a synapsid or a therapsid at some points, which we talked about during the Boba Fett episode, very early forms of mammals, which looked very reptilian. So they're kind of called stem mammals. They look like reptiles, but they were species that were on the way to becoming mammals. And what we are, we're actually synapsids as well, just a very heavily evolved form. But the majority of species that survived the last massive extinction event were very small. Lots of mammals, smaller dinosaurs that then went on to become birds. tiny little creatures that then grew bigger afterwards. Whales, for instance, tiny little mammals, which then went into the sea and became huge. So potentially that is an avenue for this creature. If it's a mammal or if it's a reptile, it's just a smaller mammal or smaller reptile that has evolved in the last 65 million years to become much larger. And there are some reasons that it could have gone undiscovered. So there are these incredible ecosystems in lots of South America, not in Brazil, which we typically associate the Amazon as being more part of, but in Guyana and in Venezuela, called tepuis, which are enormous elevated plateaus that they theorize used to be part of one massive sandstone plateau covering a huge chunk of South America. And over time, that sandstone has eroded, leaving these plateaus isolated, and they are so fucking cool. They're also known as tabletop mountains.
Yep.
Tepuis are really present, and they are really heavily undiscovered in Venezuela and Guyana. There's tons of species that have never been described before hanging around up on these things. And I think they make a really interesting ecosystem for these things to persist in. They're incredibly hard to access. Until I think about 10 years ago, the only shots we'd been able to take were kind of flyover shots of the vegetation there, because they are just sheer walls that go straight up. And they're called islands within rainforests for a reason, because they are completely isolated from each other and a lot of the time from the ecosystems that surround them, because it's just so hard for anything that's not a bird or a flying organism to get up there.
Yeah.
So what you could have had was this organism evolve and go extinct everywhere but the tepuis. Because, I mean, there are so many competitors. We kind of think of these areas as having not enormous predators, but they have things like caimans, American crocodiles, jaguars, which are seriously, to sound like a massive fucking nerd and an old man trying to be cool, jaguars are seriously fucking OP, okay?
They're insane.
They're one of my favorites.
Yeah, they bite through the skull of their prey. There's almost no other species that do that. They go for something much easier. Jaguars just go straight through penetrating the skull. It's incredible. You also have anacondas. You have, like, crazy fierce herbivores as well, like giant anteaters. That sort of thing. There's tons of stuff in the Amazon that could potentially compete with these guys. They do have some advantages. This Cthogo looks like it would be a really good climber, but it also looks like it'd do fairly well underwater as well. Having said that, so are jaguars.
Lots of weapons, large size. This is basically just a giant reptile jaguar with mandibles on its face.
Exactly. I think it would fill a very similar niche to a jaguar. And then the question is, how can a jaguar and a Cthogo exist in the same sort of ecosystem if they're filling the same niche? What I would hypothesize is that in regular areas below the tepuis, the jaguars outcompete the Cthogo through exploitation competition. So they're not directly fighting, it's just that the jaguars are much more efficient hunters than the Cthogo are, and they're taking a lot of their prey in many circumstances. But because the Cthogos are shown to be amazing climbers, I think they could potentially persist on the tepuis. Jaguars wouldn't be able to come into contact with each other, and they would potentially die out on these island areas over, not quickly. I think it would be over millions of years as the tepuis were eroded and became more disconnected. But the Cthogo could perhaps grow larger and go between these areas and persist because they are such good climbers, as we see in the movie. This thing's basically climbing up sheer walls. So I think potentially this is a species that could persist because it can move between the tepuis and maintain a reasonable sized population in these areas. Now, they are probably still going to go extinct at some point in the future. And that is made note of, I think, in the book, because the tepuis are basically firebombed by miners who want to wipe out these forests, which destroys these habitats and leads to their extinction, which is, totally realistic, to be honest, in that sense.
And a probable reason why we would not have seen this creature beforehand. So we have a lot of these people talk, I know growing up I was here about them discovering new species in the Amazon every single day, and I'm thinking, oh my god, there's like all these cool, crazy, enormous animals. Usually they're small bugs, you know, small insects, arthropods that are harder to see, or they thought that was one thing, but it's actually two different species, and there's just very slight differences, or only their DNA is different, but they look the exact same, whatever. But occasionally you have these larger organisms that do go unnoticed for a long period of time. And the best example of this that most people know about is the coelacanth, the large fish caught by fishermen off in South Africa in the early 20th century, 1914, 1918, something like that. And they were thought extinct for millions of years. But if these creatures are living in these tepuis in the middle of the Amazon, which are hard to access in a very hard to access forest in the first place, it is not impossible that a large organism like this that has low that would also have low population numbers could go unnoticed for a very long period of time and maybe only be known to the indigenous people.
And I think these would have initially been much smaller because, you know, it's hard to grow large in these sort of areas. But if you get up in these tepuis, where jaguars and crocodiles and other competitors can't get to, then all of a sudden you have access to more resources and you can grow a bit larger. Yeah. So I think that's maybe a reason that they wouldn't have shown up in any kind of fossil records of being collected is because the ones that are existing on the tepuis have grown significantly larger. There is still the problem that any species that comes into conflict with people, we're likely to hear about it because, you know, if it kills people and there's, you know, myths or legends or just, you know, everyday normal conflict, something you've got to worry about, we generally do hear about it much more easily.
I think there's a point to be made though with the area this is happening in and the people that might be dying. Because we see it, at least in the U.S., with people being killed by other people, unless they're white people or people that are maybe upper middle class or from a higher socioeconomic status, you don't really hear about it, and they don't make a big deal of it. And if this is a monster or a creature that is potentially only preying on the occasional indigenous person, the wider world and even the country itself probably wouldn't know too much about it.
Yeah, and we see this all the time with people freaking out when a wolf approaches their kindergarten. But whenever somebody in Asia or Africa or even Eastern Europe kills, you know, a lion, bear that's threatening them, we get all up in arms about it, which is fucking bullshit. Stop doing that.
Yeah, I was able to talk to a little Maasai girl in Tanzania, and she was telling us through an interpreter, but she was telling us that basically they have a system that they have to go every day to collect water because if they don't follow the system, then they'll get snatched by leopards from the trees.
Jesus.
Yeah. There was an American woman who was basically saying, I don't understand why British people are so incensed by trophy hunting in Africa when they are quite happy to sponsor fox hunts all the time in their own country. Dr. Danny Robiotti just came back with, starts with R, ends with acism. That's all there is to it and a lot of the shit.
Yep.
Yeah. That's our interpretation of what, you know, a more likely reality for this creature. Which, and I hate to say this, is what they go with for the entire first book until the epilogue, where it is suggested that Whitney, in fact, became the creature, which just
is wild.
So fucking annoying. Yeah, it's so, like you build up this reasonably credible myth, and then you just jump off the deep end in the epilogue, and that jumping off the deep end becomes the main plot of the movie. Very strange.
That's super unfortunate, because there's a much more interesting story, in my opinion.
Yeah, mine too. There could have been a really good story here about people going in and just stealing shit from other cultures and taking it back and whacking it in a museum, and the revenge here of something coming back with them to fuck them all up. And I think that could have been a really interesting story.
Yeah.
Much more interesting than this guy. I mean, I guess he is bringing back a curse and it, you know, harms all the people around him. But I don't know. I think it would have been more interesting to bring back something that you really should have left there.
Yeah. Along
with all the other shit you stole from these native people.
Yeah, it seems like that was maybe the subtext, or we're just reading into it because we want to. But the sense I got from the beginning of the movie with the indigenous people of them kind of being like, fuck you, dude. Have this. Have fun. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Don't scare me like that, colonizer.
My name is Everett.
Yes, I know.
Before we start getting into the story stuff, Adam and I don't get to talk about this a lot, but I felt there were some very honest representations of the dark side of academia in this movie.
And some very, very inaccurate ones as well.
Yeah. The worst aspect of this, I thought, was when Margot Green's students have popped up behind the window and are jokingly like holding up the skull and being like, Dr. Green, please let us go home. We want to go home. And she's like, oh, you silly scamps. Go on then. She's been keeping her students there till like 8 or 9 p.m. The museum is closed. It's dark outside. That is some seriously abusive supervisor behavior. You're a bad person, Margot Green.
One of the advantages of working in academia is that there is a great degree of flexibility to the job. You can work as much as you want. You can work as little as you want. There's obviously downsides to not working a lot at all, but it could be a situation where maybe they get in at 1 p.m. and they leave at 8 p.m., you know, a nice little 7-hour day. That's not what they're implying here. They're implying that she is a taskmaster and keeping it along, which is super, super fucked up, as Sam said. But also, in these situations, usually you just kind of do your work and you leave whenever you want to. There's not a weird system of having to report to your supervisor to then go home when you want. It's usually more of an advisor situation where they are a peer who knows more than you and you learn from them, but they don't directly tell you what to do all the time. So this is a incredibly toxic lab.
During that scene, I kept thinking of Adam, your old advisor, who was very much a, what's the opposite of a micromanager?
Hands off?
Yeah.
Laissez-faire.
Very hands off. Yeah, laissez-faire. Like, you do your work. And I kept thinking of, like, that being Adam asking him if he could go home and be like, I don't give a fuck. Like, did you do your work? Then cool. Like,
It wouldn't even make sense because he would have already been home with his family. So
yeah.
It's even better. Like, why are you calling me? I don't give a shit. Fuck you. Go away.
Yeah.
Yeah. You do get supervisors like that who are very relaxed. Just like, as long as you get the work done, I trust you to manage your time properly. But you do get labs like this.
Yes,
you do. Where, and they go hyper competitive as well. Like, you don't go home because there's other people there and you want to. And I know this happens outside of academia and tons of other things as well. I'm just saying that this woman is driving one of these labs and it's fucked up.
Also, the entitlement she seems to have about her own sense of importance, always calling it my grant. One of the unfortunate things about science is that there's a lot of uncertainty involved with academia, and you usually have to procure money from an outside organization to fund your work, your own salary, and often the people that are working with you so you can pay for them. And she mentions this, like, if I don't get this grant, my students want to have jobs. But you are competing with other people who have just as much of a right to go for this money as you do. This is not your grant, you asshole. This guy is doing... Until that guy just lied about her being in the other side of the museum and locking him in to her potential death, I was on his side 100%. He's just working and trying to get money just like she is. Go for
it. I mean, I was still on his side after that, so.
That scene where he's, you know, dressed up in the tux and he's doing like, and he's rehearsing how to be just the simpering sycophant. How rich you look today. I was like, I mean, you have to support the livelihoods of your students. Like, yeah, I'm on your side here, man.
As another quote from my supervisor is, you got to play the game. And sometimes you got to do shit like this to get the stuff to fund the science and continue doing what you want to do. And it happens.
It's an unfortunate reality of academia.
One which Margot Green would be very well aware of. And she acts like this is the first time she's ever heard of someone else competing for a grant.
She has a huge staff with incredibly expensive equipment taking up a large space in the museum. Yeah, she would be an old hat at this.
Adam, you said you had some things which were really inaccurate about it. What sort of stuff did you mean?
This movie did the scientist equivalent of what a lot of TV shows still do nowadays with, quote, hackers. In fiction. Using 18 keyboards at once, using the expression, I'm in, using words like mainframe, hard drive, just because they sound good.
12 screens of just binary code.
Yeah, exactly. It's literally the Matrix. The use of reverse transcriptase, which is an enzyme that is used in DNA to translate from, I believe it's RNA to DNA. And these are enzymes that are real. Viruses, retroviruses do use them, and as they say in the movie, like, oh, this is definitely a retrovirus, because that's what they have. Eukaryotic cells, which are cells with a nucleus, which are not viruses, also use DNA transcript or reverse transcriptase. That would be like saying, okay, we found a jacket at the crime scene, so whoever killed this person is definitely from the Northern Hemisphere. Yeah, because people from near the equator don't own jackets. Like, what the fuck are you talking about? You know better than this. You're evolutionary biologists. Shut the fuck up.
Playing devil's advocate, because I had this moment in the book.
Don't do this to me, Dave.
Where I was reading through, and at one point the pathologist says that she wants to stain the tissue she's taken with eosinophil. And I made this, like, oh, face, and I was like, it's eosin. You don't stain with eosinophil. That's a cell. And my partner looked over at me, and she's like, they're using scientific terms. You're the only one who'd be upset with this. Shut the hell up. And I did have to remember that a couple of times watching this movie, reading the book, and just being like, there were things, and I mainly just appreciated they were bringing in scientific terms to begin with. I was like, hey, you're trying.
Well, okay, so let's transition over to the story part and why that's such a problem for this movie in particular. Because what we see in this movie is no dumber than what we see in a bunch of other movies, I feel. I don't think that the science is any more off the deep end, say, than Jurassic Park.
Nope.
But the problem with this movie, I feel, is that you present such grounded, realistic characters early on who are a pretty accurate representation of lots of academia and claim to be evolutionary biologists, and then you have them spout utter rubbish.
Yes.
And just go from completely believable to what are you talking about in a heartbeat. Mm-hmm. And I think that this could have been avoided if they'd kind of done what Jurassic Park does, or what Scott Sigler was talking about when he was on, which is you introduce people slowly to stuff that is true and that they already know, and then you gradually go off the deep end.
You slip a little bit of poison in each day, not give the full dose at once.
Exactly. You build up people's tolerance slowly.
Exactly.
And this movie really doesn't do that at all.
No.
I don't even feel the books do it at all. I really think that there's no kind of easing in to the sci-fi element of the science here. I really feel it just, you know.
The hardest part that I had with it was the science itself wasn't really that relevant to the story either. And so, no. You know, you have Jurassic Park where you're doing all this scientific setup beforehand, and there's a little bit during, you know, like they're figuring out what's going wrong and things like that. But this is the whole plot is they're trying to figure out what this creature is while it's killing people. And it, to me, it's like, who the fuck would do that? They would just be like shooting it, burning it free. Like they would just be trying to kill it. Like they don't need to, you know, analyze the DNA, and I don't even know scientific terms, but you know, they don't need to do all these experiments on floor saliva to figure out that fucking fire will hurt it. Like,
yeah. I mean, she has that line at the end of like, I know what you are, who you used to be, but so what? Like, it doesn't stop or change anything. I want to say, I did still kind of like this movie. I did enjoy this movie.
I did too.
So
it was a fun time. Yeah.
What I think would have been perfectly applicable in this movie is to not explain it. I mean, you can have a little bit of setup of like the, you know, the indigenous group and coming over on the boat, like how it got there a little bit. But to be honest, like there's no need. They could have just had this boat come into the harbor. They could have started the movie right there, had this boat come into the harbor, find a bunch of dead people on it, and like, what the fuck's going on? You don't necessarily need to break down the chaos that's happening to make it a good movie. Sometimes the mayhem and the confusion of what it is good enough. I mean, just look at Cloverfield. We did that, and that's something that we all really loved about the movie, is that they didn't necessarily explain or go hours into explaining where the fuck this thing came from. It was just a group of people like, there's a big skyscraper-sized monster, and we're just trying to survive. Like, this is nuts.
Yeah.
And I think they could have done that with this movie. They didn't need the whole, let's, you know, analyze the DNA while we're trying not to get our heads bitten off.
Can we be faster?
Patience is a virtue.
Not right now, it isn't.
So for my section today, I wanted to talk about actual South American cryptids and myths and just get y'all's take on maybe where these came from. So the first one I wanted to talk about is the Alicanto. So the Alicanto is a magical nocturnal bird. It looks kind of nondescript in daylight, but at night or in the darkness, it has golden light that gleams from its wings. It has luminous laser beam eyes. And some other versions say that its feathers are metallic or have a metallic glow. According to the legend, the Alicanto subsists on eating gold and silver. It does not fly, but runs out with its arms extended. Not because it can't fly, because if it's well fed, then the gold and silver render it too heavy for flight. So presumably a less well fed Alicanto flies quite well. So there's two versions.
I would say that a nocturnal bird would not want to stand out, probably.
Nor fly.
Or a cave-dwelling bird. So the two versions of the myth say that if the Alicanto is unaware of your presence, it will lead you to treasure. But if it sees you, it will lead you to jagged cliffs or your doom. Or, alternatively, but similar, if it favors you, it'll lead you to treasure. But if it doesn't like you or thinks you kind of deserve it, aka Margot Green, the bird will lead you to danger.
How do you know if it sees you?
Well, I assume the laser beam eyes block it.
It's got laser beams, right?
Yeah, I forgot about the laser beam eyes. How could I forget about the laser beam eyes?
So my question for you, I just wanted to kind of briefly see where you think maybe these cryptids came from in real life, as far as real life animal inspiration.
Birds of paradise.
Yeah.
Straight up. Birds of paradise are incredible creatures, and they're the closest thing we have to anything phoenix or Alicanto-like. Problem is, they're in a completely different part of the world.
And small. How big is the Alicanto?
It doesn't say. It doesn't ever give a real size. I mean, they can live in mines, so they're, you know, obviously that's where they eat, so I assume that they aren't necessarily that big.
Because it sounds a lot like a South American version of the Mothman, which is often associated with, like, the most famous Mothman incident is a bridge collapsing in West Virginia. A lot of people died.
Oh, I was worried that the inspiration was just simply a guy who kept stealing gold from other people dressed in a giant bird costume the entire time. Alicanto! Alicanto! Give me your watch.
I think what we've got here is just a species of quetzal. Quetzals are really beautiful South American birds that has just, you know, there's been a genetic mutation every once in a while, and they've turned out gold or silvery, which, like I said, is not very good for, you know, trying to avoid predators or trying not to be seen by prey. But it could potentially just be the males who have this, you know, happen once in a while, and people have attributed, you know, special meaning to it.
And if it has any form of nocturnal vision or any semblance of night vision, it would have the depiction of lucidum, which would give it eyeshine, aka laser eyes.
There you go. Yeah. All right, I'm going to move on to my next one. I feel like Dave's going to really like this one for some reason. So this one's called the El Cuero. So it is another Chilean, but also Southern Argentinian cryptid. El Cuero, meaning the leather, also known as El Cuero Vivo, meaning the living leather, is a creature that inhabits the sea and some rivers of Chile and the south of Argentina. Locals say it is an extremely dangerous creature, describing it as having a hairless head and spine, and a body which has the appearance of cowhide, which has been splayed out to dry, hence the name. It has teeth-like protuberances around the edges of its body, used to latch on and secure the prey, and a pair of red eyes upon stalks like those of the snail. When there's prey nearby, El Cuero jumps from the water to show its mouth, which is located in the middle of its body that looks like a giant sucker or
protuberance.
Oh my god, I can't say this word.
Proboscis.
No, proboscis, thank you. A giant sucker or proboscis. Then, after covering its victim completely, El Cuero uses its mouth to absorb and drain its fluids, leaving only a lifeless shell behind.
Yeah, I definitely... I
think this is an octopus.
No, I looked up pictures of this on Google Images, and...
More like a crazy clam, I feel.
It looks like an amoeba cow.
It's more, I think it's more like stingray body.
Yeah, it's like flat, like Stephen King's The Raft, except the creature doesn't look like an oil slick. It has cow pattern.
I've got a couple of things here that say essentially it could have been a freshwater stingray that somebody misinterpreted. Mm-hmm. Or have you guys seen Mata Mata turtles before? I think I've shown you photos of them before.
Yes.
Look up Mata Mata turtles because they are horrific looking. M-A-T-A-M-A-T-A.
All right. So then I have the Mapinguari, which is Brazilian. And this one actually has a backstory. So according to the tales, the creature was once an Amazonian shaman who discovered the key to immortality thousands of years ago. His discovery angered the gods and he was severely punished. Forced him to become a wandering hairy beast for the rest of his life, which, thanks to his discovery, was eternity. So many cryptozoologists speculate that the Mapinguari is either a, I'm going to say these words wrong, Sam, I'm so sorry, Mylondontid, or a megalon. I'm going to put them in chat.
Mylondontid?
Mylondontid, or megalonchid. Anyways.
No idea, yeah.
Many cryptozoologists speculate that it is a basically a medium-sized giant ground sloth from the Ice Age that lives in the area. So the creature also supposedly has a horrid odor, which can knock a man unconscious, and is sometimes said to be a humanoid creature with a mouth in the middle of its stomach, one eye, long claws, caiman skin, backwards feet, and a second mouth on its belly.
This sounds like a brother and sister got frisky, and
and then their son got frisky with their daughter.
The sloth reject lived in the woods.
have you been to Tasmania?
The last one is my personal favorite, called the Buraro, which comes from Colombia. But more specifically, the Tucano people, which are an indigenous group in that area. So Buraro, meaning the pale ones, is a grotesque creature. It has backwards facing feet to confuse its foes. It's very tall, tree-sized, pale skin, but covered in black fur. It has large forward-facing ears, fangs, and huge pendulous genitalia. It has no joints in its knees. No joints in its knees. So if it falls down, it has great trouble getting up. It's said to be the protector of wildlife. It uses two main ways to kill its victims. First, its urine is a lethal poison. Secondly, if it catches a victim in its embrace, it will crush them without breaking skin or bones. And it crushes them until their flesh is pulp. Then it drinks the pulp through a small hole made in the victim's head, after which the victim's empty skin is inflated like a balloon, and then they are sent home in a daze where they subsequently die.
That's horrifying.
So the liquids being sucked out of their body doesn't kill them?
No. Because they inflates it. Okay. They inflate it like a balloon to replace the flesh.
Obviously, Sam.
As you already know, it can be placated by tobacco, but to escape, you can either place your hands in its footprints, which will cause its legs to stiffen and fall, or alternatively, you run backwards while facing it, which confuses the hell out of it.
I'm going to go with the running backwards while facing it. I'm not touching this thing's footprints.
I feel like I should try to pee on it to see if my urine kills it.
I think large pendulous genitalia is probably the most
aspect of this.
Monsters are scary enough, but if there's like a scrotum that is touching the ground, like a bowl, that's horrendous. And I would not want to fuck with it.
And also joints in its knees.
How does it run?
Awkwardly.
Yeah, with great...
No wonder it gets confused. With
great difficulty trying to protect its pendulous genitalia from banging against anything on the ground.
That is a weird combination of features for it to have, though.
Yeah.
I think that this is just one of those unfortunate circumstances of a poor outcast from the village who maybe had difficulty walking and prefer not to wear clothing, and maybe also had some kind of testicular cancer or a disease that's really, really swelled up the testicles and led to maybe some fear of this gentleman and leading it to them saying, like, oh, it's a monster. No, that's Dave. Sorry, I don't know why I said Dave.
See, I think it's the little kid was like pulling the cat's tail too hard. And so the mom or dad came in and told them not to, like, that we need to protect, you know, animals. And the kid was like, well, why? And then they're like, well, otherwise, if you don't, this creature will come get you. And the kid was like, well, what is that creature? And the kid just kept playing the why game. And the parents just kept adding shit to this creature because they had no sense of creativity. Well,
I will say the long...
or maybe too much.
The longer you explain monsters between this episode and The Witcher, which have all these, like, they've got these complicated joints and all these extra rules. And then you get to, like, North American myths. And it's like, imagine a really hairy man who lives in the woods. And you're like, and they're like, that's it. That's it. Go look for him.
I cannot recommend enough, by the way. If you enjoy hearing about cryptids like this, you should definitely, if you're on Twitter, follow a guy called Darren Naish, at Tetzu, T-E-T-Z-O-O. He does these enormous breakdowns of different cryptid creatures and the myths around them on, like, kind of a fortnightly basis, including stuff like the Loch Ness, the sea dragons, and that sort of stuff. Mainly whale penises, to be fair. But he does incredible breakdowns of their histories and the people who have worked with them and on these species as well.
Cool.
Cryptozoologists. It's fascinating. Yeah.
Everything you're about to do is earth-shattering, and it will change how humanity views some of nature's oddities.
So, do we feel bad for the Kathoga?
Yes.
If the Kathoga is the doctor, absolutely. If it's a monster that, or sorry, an animal that was somehow transported from South America to Chicago, absolutely. It's bad either way.
Yeah.
This poor thing's just confused no matter what.
And addicted. You've addicted either an animal or a human to some sort of harmful substance, and it's forced to run around eating people to try and make up its habit.
In a big old panic.
Yeah. Would we recommend this movie?
I would.
It's a cool monster.
It's definitely got its flaws, but it's a cool monster, and it's still a fun time overall, I would say.
I think if you like 90s, then yes. Like, if you like the 90s aesthetic, then yes. So, it's fun.
Yeah. To echo what Libby was saying a little bit earlier, if this was 10, 15 minutes shorter, absolutely. I think it is. It clocks in at close to 2 hours, which is too much for this sort of kind of pulpy fluff. Mm-hmm. So I'm kind of on the fence, and I don't really have a good answer. But interesting, so I asked Adam this when we talked about The Witcher. Dave, if people like this movie, would you, or if people don't like this movie, would you recommend the book?
Yeah, most of the book up until exactly the same thing you ran into with the epilogue at the end follows by a very different path than what we see in the movie. It's a much slower burn. Even the death of the monster is quite different. Like, the death of the monster is very subtle.
And I've got to be honest, I run into the same problem with the book. If it was 100 pages shorter, absolutely. But 480 pages is too much for this sort of shit.
So next week we'll be taking a page from our Deep Rock Galactic playbook, where we'll be returning to the world of video games for a brief foray into the Halo franchise. There's a ton to talk about there. This is a series near and dear to my heart.
As is mine.
One of the few video games that I actually have a lot of nostalgia for as well.
Oh, perfect.
Sam and I got drunk when I first met him in the first summer he lived with me, and we played this video game through a couple of times.
Did we play it through?
We played Halo. We got the cooperative on Halo.
Which...
obviously, Sam was more drunk than you.
But as we say here at the end of every episode, the monsters aren't real, but the science is.
Bye, guys.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
33% Homo sapien.
Pardon? What are you talking about?
Gradual extinction of the human race.